up at the parades because, you know, to get your name out there and to meet with the constituents and talk with them and make sure that they know that you're in the race.
Politicians hone their skills at the Colony Days Parade in Palmer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Department of Justice proposal to put more polling places on tribal lands.
For more geography or the inability to speak English, do not free any of us from the obligations and responsibilities of citizenship.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity plans to fight a lawsuit challenging the state's ban on same-sex marriage. The Department of Law, in a statement, says the Attorney General's office has a duty to uphold and defend the Alaska Constitution, which it intends to do. The department says the state's position will be more fully laid out in future court filings. Alaska voters in 1998 approved a constitutional amendment defining marriage as between one man and one woman. Five same-sex couples, four married outside Alaska, and one unmarried couple sued in federal court last month, seeking to strike down the ban on gay marriage. They say the ban violates their right to due process and equal protection under the U.S. Constitution. Now that the filing deadline has passed, campaign season in Alaska has started in earnest. That means a lot of TV ads, a lot of yard signs, and a lot of glad-handing. For the next few months, politicians are going to be swarming fairs and festivals in an effort to win voters. The Colony Days Parade held in Palmer this weekend was the first stop on the circuit. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has the story.
The Colony Days Parade lasted 2 whole hours this year. In between the floats from sports teams, churches, and the local utility, there was a lot of this.
All right, Dan Sullivan for Lieutenant Governor. Here's Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, hello. And his wife, Lynette. Mayor Sullivan is in
It was a literal parade of political candidates, where just about every other participant was asking for your vote. Sullivan had a volunteer wearing a green wig and propped up on stilts for his float. Members of Palmer Representative Shelley Hughes' entourage formed a kick line. Her opponent, Democrat Peter LaFrance, had a guy dressed as a Yeti. All of the major candidates for governor were there, and so were most of the U.S. Senate candidates. But events like these are especially important for first-timers running for office, like Kathy Tilton.
It's important to show up at the parades because, you know, to get your name out there and to meet with the constituents and talk with them and make sure that they know that you're in the race.
Tilton is a Republican running for an open house seat in the Chugiak area. She's been to Colony Days before, and she says the difference between an election year and an off year is pretty obvious.
During a non-election year, the parade is not as full of floats and people. I heard there's about 85 this year, and I think there's been years when there's been maybe 30. So it's a little more robust this year, we could say.
This isn't the only event Tilton will go to before the August 19th primary. There are 4th of July parades and the state fair and plenty more. That's a lot of marching to do and a lot of fried food to consume.
Well, it's all going to depend on how many doors I walk to, how many funnel cakes I'm allowed to have.
Tilton's not the only one to see a difference between parades in odd years and even ones. Spectator Stacy Quarapel grew up in Palmer, and she's been attending Colony Days for years.
The kids don't really get into it as much anymore. You don't see the 4-H groups in it as much anymore, and it's kind of sad.
Quarapel has some misgivings about all the campaigning. She says the parade now feels more like a political event than a community celebration.
From when we were younger till now, there's a lot more political now. It's become very political.
About a block away from Quarapel, Jim Daggett of Wasilla is hanging out by the orchestra. He's got a Sean Parnell for governor sign that he picked up during the parade, and he doesn't have a problem with candidate appearances.
They gotta shake hands and kiss babies, right?
Daggett says it's nice to see everyone out in person. It gives him a sense of whether the candidates are taking the campaign seriously and if they have popular support, something you can't really tell from a campaign ad. Rose Lecouche, also a Wasilla, is standing next to him, and she agrees. Appearances like these aren't driving her decision on election day, but it gives her a sense of who's running and what a candidate is like.
It's a time for them to actually look people right in the eye and to shake their hands. You can't completely judge a person's character by what you see for a few seconds, but you sure can get an impression.
And between the signs they wave and all the bags of candy they hand out, the candidates marching are hoping it's a good one. In Palmer, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A grassroots effort to repeal Senate Bill 21 kicked off last weekend. Meetings of the Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway campaign took place from Anchorage to Unalaska, where organizers are struggling to convince residents that oil taxes matters in their community. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
Last Thursday, Unalaska's library conference room was open to anyone opposed to Senate Bill 21, which cuts taxes for oil companies as an incentive for development. An hour after the doors opened, the room sounded like this. Nobody showed up to volunteer or record a video proclaiming their support. Local organizer Cheryl Lakanoff says it's frustrating, but not altogether surprising.
Right now, I think we really are up against a lot in this community.
Lakanoff's worried residents don't know how oil taxes factor into their daily lives.
Right now, budgets all over the state are getting cut. Education, roads, infrastructure. That money comes from oil tax revenue. Well, why are we letting them pay less in taxes when, if anything, we need more revenue?
Right now, most of Unalaska's money comes from taxes on the fishing industry, but oil has been a bigger presence in town over the past several years, and that has some residents wondering if the town's finances will depend on that industry down the road.
We certainly think that it would help to cut the taxes, so to encourage them to come in here and start doing this business.
That's Greg Pavlik, who's worked for a shipping company in Unalaska for the past 2 years. He says Inchcape is putting their operations on hold due to a lack of oil activity in the Arctic this summer. As a businessman, Pavlik thinks cutting oil taxes was the right thing to do. And as a resident, he didn't have a lot of concerns about how declining state revenues would trickle down to him. That's not uncommon, but according to Unalaska City Manager Chris Laddick, state money pays for a lot of different services here.
One is the schools, right? You have funding for the university, fish and game jobs. The airport is run by the state. You have state grants. So I think if you really start thinking about it, there's quite a bit. So we're all relying on what's happening on the slope with the amount of oil extraction that's going on one way or another.
And that's to say nothing of capital projects. In just the past few years, the city's gotten tens of millions from the state for a new boat harbor and public utilities. That's thanks in large part to the lobbyists the city employs in Juneau and Dutch Harbor's clout as a major fishing port. Those are pretty easy to take for granted, so it's tough to say what'll happen when residents are asked to cast a vote on the subject. And it's even harder to know just how many will show up at the polls. The last time there was an August primary, just 12% of Unalaska's registered voters participated. Back at the public library, Cheryl Lakanoff is still waiting for supporters to show up. She's wondering if maybe she should have offered free food. Still, she's not losing hope.
Regardless of the fact that there's nobody here, I know there are people that are going to vote yes.
The question is how to find them. Lakanoff says she's got friends involved in the campaign. They were out of town the night of the meeting. But she's hoping they can go door to door this summer and bring the issue to residents before it goes to a vote in August. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, on the 10th anniversary of the Dental Health Aid Therapist Program, some dentists are still critical.
I see this as an evolving issue, which hopefully over time will be embraced by all of the dental profession.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The National Congress of American Indians is holding their mid-year conference in Anchorage this week, titled Claiming Our Rights and Strengthening Our Governance. The conference started yesterday and runs through Wednesday. U.S. Department of Justice Assistant Attorney General Tony West adhered to the theme, as he said DOJ would work with tribes to enhance access to voting.
And so the Attorney General announced today that we would engage in consultation with tribal leaders to come up with legislative proposals that would hopefully, at the end of the day, would result in polling places in local Native communities, on reservations, in Native villages, as well as ensuring that election materials, ballot materials are being presented and offered in those Native languages.
State Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says remote precincts have a polling place in the most populated part of the precinct, and other areas are designated permanent absentee voting areas. Voters in these areas can apply to have an absentee ballot mailed to them. West made it clear that Justice Department officials strongly support tribal government sovereignty and will work to help clarify jurisdiction issues in Alaska, particularly as it relates to domestic violence and sexual assault.
In the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, we are making sure that there are funds and resources available to try to deal with sex trafficking, to try to deal with violence against women. We strongly support the repeal of Section 910 of the Violence Against Women Act, which took Alaska Native villages outside of this ability of tribes to exercise special criminal jurisdiction and pursue, in certain instances, domestic violence perpetrators.
Speaking earlier to a large group at the Denaina Convention Center, West said DOJ filed a statement of interest last week in a case called Tyokuk versus Treadwell. Plaintiff Mike Tyokuk of the village of Manicotic is suing the state over a failure to provide oral language assistance for citizens who speak Yupik as their first language.
Because if remote geography or the inability to speak English do not free any of us from the obligations and responsibilities of citizenship, then they should not impede the exercise of rights to which we are all entitled.
That case will go to trial later this month. A federal judge has said the constitutional right to vote requires the state of Alaska to translate all election materials into Native languages for voters lacking English proficiency. A congressional effort to reach the same goal is also in the works. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich was working to change the election process in Alaska to turn back to what he calls protections that were in place until a year ago. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it's unconstitutional to require 9 states with a history of discrimination, including Alaska, to get federal preclearance on election changes. Begich recently introduced the Native Voting Rights Bill in Congress.
In Alaska, this will do a couple things that I think are pretty important and ensure that ballots are translated into all written Native languages. It will make sure that the state just can't close down polling booths and deciding where election booths should go without the Justice Department participating and reviewing those, and also a consultation between the Department of Justice and tribes.
Native American rights attorney Natalie Landreth says the bill would reinstate federal scrutiny of some election changes.
Not as to all election changes, but only for specific kinds of things that are inherently suspect, such as taking away early voting, removing the only polling place in a village, combining polling places in villages that are separated, that kind of a thing. So you wouldn't have preclearance for all voting changes, just this small subset of them.
Landreth says the legislation is needed because Alaska has a dual system for elections, one for urban areas and a less accessible, less convenient one for rural Alaska.
I think a lot of people are unaware, those of us that live in cities, we're unaware of some of the existing voting barriers in rural Alaska. Most of rural Alaska does not have early voting. A lot of villages have no polling places. There are over 70 now that have no polling places at all.
In the 1960s, Alaska was tagged for preclearance because it provided English-only election materials and ballots to voters. The state has argued translations into native languages are useless because the languages are spoken, not written, and few natives read their language. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, a Republican candidate for Begich's Senate seat, says the state sided with Alabama in the Supreme Court case because Alaska elections are fair, and he says preclearance is an unnecessary waste of time.
Federal overreach on our elections had gotten so absurd that I could not even put an email address on a voter registration form without getting Justice Department permission.
Treadwell says he's kept every polling place open that was there when he was elected, and he's taken steps to have more. Treadwell says he's open to a dialogue about how to improve elections.
Elections are a sacred right, and I don't want this to become a political football. It's very, very good that we do everything we can to expand access to elections.
Other Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate, Dan Sullivan and Joe Miller, did not respond to email requests for comments on the Native Voting Rights Bill in time for this broadcast. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has issued an emergency order prohibiting sport fishermen from targeting king salmon on the Gonnekduck River. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Sport Fish Division Area Biologist John Chaithluk says new sport restrictions are now in effect for a vast area, including the Gonnekduck River near Gwinnahaq.
Division of Sport Fish closed the entire Kuskum drainage and the Kuskum Bay drainage to sport fishing for king salmon, effectively Thursday, May 1, 2014, and so that precludes any catch and release as well. If they accidentally catch a king salmon while they're fishing for another species, that king salmon may not be removed from the water and must be released immediately.
Chaithluk said this restriction was the result of an emergency order issued around the end of April. Like rivers all over Alaska, king escapement has been dwindling in recent years on the Gonnekduck River. The emergency order states that only one unbaited artificial lure may be used in the Kuskokwim Good News area. There are four guide companies operating on the Gonnekduck River. They provide guided fishing trips, among other wilderness services. There is a history of friction between subsistence fishers there and the guiding operations. At a meeting held in Gwinnahaq on May 30th, local fisher Willard Church says he's doubtful that the guide companies will stop targeting king salmon as they try to cater to their clients.
If I was someone coming up from New York on a float boat trip for the very first time with a group of 12, I'd want my king, especially if I could get it up there.
Of the four guiding outfits operating on the Gonnekduck River, three are currently advertising king salmon as a species anglers can expect to catch. Alaska West, which has the largest operation on the Gonnekduck River, according to local residents, has this on their website regarding king salmon. Quote, "At Alaska West, we have honed and refined our fly angling skills and collective knowledge to a point where we consistently hook and land these behemoth masses that more resemble chrome-plated sea lions than fish." Brian Burke, a sales representative for Alaska West, declined to be interviewed, but stated that their website is up to date. Owner of another sport fishing guide company called Real Action, Paul Jacob said his company will be complying with their restrictions. He says he makes that clear to all his potential customers, but Jacob says sport fishers must purchase stamps from Fish and Game and that revenue goes towards things like salmon research. He says taking down the king salmon advertising on his website would be counterproductive.
I don't believe that there's a good reason to do that because it throws fear into the general public about coming to Alaska. And the research that is done to figure out why these salmon are crashing, it's not just the Kuskokwim, it's all across all of Alaska. And when you scare people away by having them not come up to Alaska, you take away the funding that it takes to figure out why king salmon are not doing well in the ocean.
Meanwhile, Paul Hansen owns another guide operation called Alaska Rainbow Adventures. Hansen says he'll be moving king salmon anglers to the Alaganak River near King Salmon, where sport fishing for king salmon are allowed through king salmon stamps. While the guide companies around the area appear to comply to recent restrictions, in Gwinnahaq, many aren't convinced, like John T. Roberts. Roberts lives in the village and once worked as a sport guide. He recounts his experiences in the Gonnekduck River.
One of my experiences on the river with them, I went next to one of the boats. I saw a jack and a larger king. They tried to lie to me that it was a different species.
It's not a different species. It's king salmon. I've been here long enough, I know.
Department of Fish and Game says wildlife troopers will be making unannounced visits to sport fishing sites to ensure these restrictions are not violated. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A group of six dental health aid therapists graduated from training Friday in Anchorage. The ceremony also marked the 10th anniversary of the innovative program that places mid-level dental practitioners in underserved rural communities across Alaska. 81 villages in the state now have therapists. Former Secretary of Health and Human Services Dr. Lewis Sullivan spoke at the graduation. Sullivan says the American Dental Association has strongly opposed the program from the beginning, but he says dental health aid therapists help expand the reach of dentists.
So I'm hoping that our colleagues in dentistry will see the wisdom, the utility, and the humanity of such a program, and that they'll come around and support this. And by the way, I'd say we had in medicine a similar challenge when physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners were introduced back in the 60s and 70s. The American Medical Association and physicians generally really were opposed to this. They had some of the similar arguments here that have been given, but that fight is over. So in medicine, we've seen the evolution of mid-level practitioners who are now well accepted. I see the same thing happening in dentistry. Dentistry happens to be about 50 years behind medicine in that regard.
The criticism and concern that you heard from the dental community, has that, now that we're 10 years down the road with this program, has some of that quieted down now?
I can't say that it is quieted down. I would say this, that the National Dental Association, which is Association of African American Dentists, and the National Hispanic Dental Association, as well as the Dental Association for Native Americans, are supportive of the program. I believe that is because they do see the tremendous need for such a program. They see the individuals and the communities that have dental cavities and loss of teeth and other oral health problems that are afflicting those communities. So they have been more supportive of this concept. So clearly, there's not uniform resistance for this in the dental communities. And a number of white dentists as well are supportive of development of dental therapists. So I see this as an evolving issue, which hopefully over time will be embraced by all of the dental profession.
Have there been any problems? Have any of the fears that dentists had expressed about therapists working on teeth come to pass?
No, not to my knowledge. There have been a number of evaluations of the program, the quality of the care. And I should also point out that the number and the kinds of procedures that dental therapists provide are limited. They are usually preventive services and dental education, fluoride washes, extractions of diseased teeth, filling of teeth, or application of sealants. So I think this is the proof of the pudding, and this is why such a program like this is going to be adopted all over the country.
You talked a little bit about physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners, but Dr. Sullivan, if more states consider this dental therapist program and go this route, what do you think this could mean for other aspects of healthcare? Could community health aides, something that are in villages here in Alaska, do you think that that's a concept that might spread more broadly to the rest of rural America?
Oh, very definitely. It could, and I predict that it will. Healthcare is a science-based profession, but the delivery of health services occurs in a social setting. That means you have to have an individual who is fluent in the language, who's able to establish good communication and trust, who understands the value system of the individual, the patient that they are serving, and who's able to develop an ongoing relationship so that the patient understands and accepts and implements the recommendations. And so therefore, we have to have health professionals who are able to address these problems, which is working with their patients as partners in protecting and enhancing their health. So those are some of the challenges that we confront today.
Dr. Lewis Sullivan is former Secretary of Health and Human Services and current CEO of the Sullivan Alliance. This week, the Anchorage Museum reached a new level of recognition when it became a Smithsonian affiliate, making it the only institution in Alaska that's part of the Smithsonian's network of 160 museums. APRN intern Joaquin Palomino has the story.
On the Smithsonian's website, there's a map that shows all of its partners across the country. 20 small red dots crowd California, each one representing a different museum. Washington State has about a half a dozen Smithsonian affiliates. Alaska, though, had none. Julie Decker, the Anchorage Museum's director, is excited about the partnership.
To be able to be associated with a national organization is good for Alaska. I think it provides a lot of opportunities for Alaska to be connected in a way that's very real and authentic, too.
Teaming up with the world's largest museum has its perks. Chief among them is that the Anchorage Museum can now more easily borrow items from the Smithsonian's vast collection. The museum will also have greater access to grants, researchers, and conferences because of the new collaboration.
We've put ourselves in a place where we are part of this national and international network of museums and affiliates, and I think that's an important opportunity for us as a museum, but more importantly for our members and our community to have that connection too.
The partnership is new, and the Anchorage Museum has only just begun discussing which items to try and bring to the state. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Joaquin Palomino from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Doy Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.